Welcome back to part two of We Love Movies with me, Gordon Hayden. Still to come, we'll be counting down the best Stephen King film adaptations with Andy McCarroll. But first, it's time to turn our attention to The Hitman's Bodyguard. Here are the film stars now, Ryan Reynolds and Samuel L. Jackson, talking about their experience making the action comedy.
My job is to keep you out of harm's way.
I think we both kind of knew that we had chemistry. Yeah. I mean, once in a while you can sort of see someone out there in this community that we all work in and go, I would definitely hit it off with that guy.
On three. One.
My bad. You're bad.
Chemistry's everything. You're dead in a movie like this if you don't have that.
So much for your intricately calculated travel plan. That's why I was trying to bounce on your ass. See, I'm safe on my own.
There's no way that they could have known where we were.
Yeah, well, they did, and now they did.
My character's a tight ass. He's, like, full of hubris and pride, and he's, you know, inevitably he's kind of a joke in his personal life, his professional
life.
Good
with a knife, a gun, and assorted other weapons.
Yes, he's very good at unblinking violence, but beyond that, he's not good at any of the important stuff. This guy right here is really great at the unblinking violence, but is also very good with the heart. He's like, we both have something to learn from each other.
So. I have passion.
Yes, he does. He does. He has passion. So it's a great fit.
Now in We Love Movies, we are going to review the combination of Ryan Reynolds and Samuel L. Jackson in a new action comedy called The Hitman's Bodyguard from Patrick Hughes, the director of Expendables 3. Straight away, there are alarm bells. Rory Cashin is with me here now to talk about it.
Hello.
Patrick Hughes, a director I thought of some note with Red Hill, his first Australian Western.
Yep.
Which I thought, this guy now has a lot of promise.
Yep.
Then Stallone came calling. Expendables 3 was just a mess. It didn't know what it wanted to be. Did it want to be a vicious action movie, or did it want to play to a younger, tweeny crowd? Hence why you got the 12A certificate.
Yep.
And it was just awful, 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 awful. And I thought poor old Patrick Hughes' career has been derailed. So fingers crossed, Rory, he's managed to get things back on track. Because the trailer to this looked very promising. What did you think of the trailer just before we get into the plot?
Oh, the trailer came from nowhere. I had no idea this film was even being made. And then when the trailer landed, I was like, this looks hilarious. Really, really good. Reynolds and Jackson, what a great pairing. And some of the action looked pretty decent. And the premise of it was good. Like someone who has to bodyguard a hitman. That's original. I haven't heard that before.
Yeah.
And they clearly hate each other. So yeah, no, I was like, oh, potential. And then when it came up directed by Patrick Hughes, I was like, oh.
Yeah, it's like, oh no. Do you know what this reminds me of? Do you remember Midnight Run with Robert De Niro?
Yes.
And Charles Grodin?
Yes.
That oddball couple, they're forced to be with each other for a period of time. This to me looks like the sort of the newer version of that.
There's a certain vibe of that. There's a certain kind of early John Woo 90s over the top, like Bruckheimer-y actions kind of vibe to it. There's not a car in the world that they don't cross that doesn't end up exploding for some reason or other. And you know, there's a Twitter account called Exploding Helicopters where all they do was list a film by how many helicopters have exploded. And they're going to go to town on this because there's exploding helicopters.
There's a lot
of that. It's just wanton destruction, and you've got two really good leads mixed up in an Atomic Blonde-esque, why is this so complicated plot?
Oh, no. Okay, right, okay. Let's just take a little bit from the trailer, Rory, before we continue on with our review of The Hitman's Bodyguard.
I'm a AAA-rated executive protection agent. And you're the most wanted hitman in the world. My job is to keep you out of harm's way.
And
I'll be safer on my own.
And I will always love you.
I hope they kill him, I really do.
Suspects are on the roof.
No odds in that job. Just gotta find a more intelligent way.
Rory Cashin joins me as we review The Hitman's Bodyguard. So it's all there in the title, really. So what does he try to essentially keep save him from?
Okay, so Samuel L. Jackson is a hitman and he's killed, you know, hundreds of people as a hitman, but he has vital information against a fascist dictator in, I think it's Belarus, played by Gary Oldman, who I didn't know was in this film before I started watching it.
Yeah.
So he's made a deal with the Justice Department to give the information against Gary Oldman, and they will then release Samuel Jackson's wife from prison, who's played by Salma Hayek, who I didn't know was in this film before I started watching it. And so this deal is being made. So he just they just need to get Samuel Jackson from London to The Hague, which is in Amsterdam, so that should be easy enough. The whole... Everyone is, you know, out to get them. It's a bit like, was it SWAT?
Oh, do you remember? With the Colin Farrell and Samuel Jackson. Yeah, do you remember?
It has that kind of, like, everyone in the city is trying to kill this one person because he's got a massive price on his head.
Yeah.
So they call in a disgraced bodyguard who's played by Ryan Reynolds because he used to be, like, this amazing bodyguard, but then one thing went wrong and then years later he's disgraced and he's just minding, like, terrible people to help bring him to The Hague. But it turns out the two of them have some very vicious history because Samuel Jackson has previously tried to kill Ryan Reynolds' character a number of times. But it's only up to Ryan to get Samuel to The Hague, get the evidence against Gary Oldman, and then potentially happily ever after.
Okay, and does it take a genius to work out, because obviously they're poles apart, that over the course of the action that they will form this sort of bond, like the way Steve Martin and John Candy were forced together, and through the ups and downs they just start to and kind of work toward forming a friendship?
Kind of. They never really get to like each other, but they hate each other less. I think that's the most I can say for their relationship.
Okay.
But they have fantastic chemistry together. The back and forth is really, really funny. Ryan Reynolds, it just is like a brilliant comedian. His comic timing is just perfectly on point. Samuel Jackson, he loves his favourite word.
Yeah.
And he says it a lot in this film. A lot. And some of the action sequences, as I said, they have a really 90s vibe to them. In that they're very very well choreographed, very clean to look at. There's some great shootouts and some great car chases, but you can definitely see there's points where the budget did not quite reach his imagination. At the opening of the film, there's a massive bombing, and it's clear that that never happened. That is pure CGI, but it's like it's not good CGI. So when the money ran out, you can tell, and you're like, ugh. But for most of the action sequences, it's fine. My biggest problem is the plot, in that Samuel Jackson getting him to the court, simple enough. Every time it cuts away to Gary Oldman and is explaining why he's such a bad guy, it gets so ridiculously dark. Like, they go into detail about the terrible things he's done as a Belarusian dictator, and it is crazy dark. Like, different film, different rating, different genre, kind of dark. And Oldman seems to have wandered in from Air Force One with that accent from Russia, but like he's half Dracula,
right?
And he is just like, the stuff he does in this film, you're just like,
where are you going, Gary?
Yeah, this is way too dark for the two lads who were just having a bit of bants in the car, and now you're over here like killing entire villages just because they're in your way.
That's a bit all over the shop, really.
Yeah.
It's like last week when we were talking about Atomic Blonde. For what should have been such a simple story, it just got way too overcomplicated for its own good. So, Rory, chemistry seems great. Unfortunately, budget constraints obviously hamper some of the action set pieces. And what the hell is going on with Gary Oldman's character story? Because it just seems like it's been torpedoed in from another film altogether. So I feel there's a real mixed bag going on here, Rory. But is there enough there to garner a bit of enjoyment?
Yes. The two leads are great together. Salma Hayek is hilarious in this as well.
She is really. She's got great comedy timing.
She most of the stuff she does, she's even in scenes on her own, and she's still hilarious. It's just every time the plot like is like, remember me, you're like, oh God. But yeah, for the most part, there's a lot to enjoy. The action sequences are great, and I would give it 6.5 out of 10.
Okay.
Decent.
Rory Cashin, thank you so much for that. That is our review of The Hitman's Bodyguard. We Love Movies with Gordon Hayden. Joining me once again now on We Love Movies is Andy McCarroll, because in the first half of the programme, we were talking about some of the worst Stephen King film adaptations. Now, though, Andy is going through some of the best. And you may be surprised that this film is not in Andy's top 5. Here's a little bit from it.
I can remember When I was a little boy, my grandmother and I could hold conversations entirely without ever opening our mouths. She called it shining. And for a long time, I thought it was just the two of us that had the shine to us. Just like you probably thought you was the only one. But there are other folks, though mostly they don't know it or don't believe it.
The film in question is, of course, The Shining. Andy, how come this didn't make your top five list?
It's a film, I really enjoy the film, but I think this kind of, obviously it's a fantastic film, but for me this suffers from the fact that it's kind of remembered for the performance as opposed to the film itself. It's very much, you know, like, for me, Batman Begins is the best Batman film, but the best thing in all the Batman films is Heath Ledger's performance as the Joker. Mm. And I do think that Jack Nicholson's performance in The Shining is one of the best things across all Stephen King adaptations. But for me, I don't think the film is quite as good as the films I have in my top five. Again, it's a personal list, and judging by the vitriol I'm getting online, a lot of people disagree with The Shining not being in the top five. But for me, I think there's films I enjoyed more than that. Not to say I didn't enjoy it, I really did. A lot more than I can say for that. The documentary last year, was it Room 237?
Oh, yeah.
Which was one of the worst things I've ever seen. Actually, you should put that on the list. One of the worst Stephen King adaptations. That was just god-awful. It was like a YouTube comment section came to life. But yeah, The Shining, I love The Shining, but sadly not in the top five.
Now, Andy, let us move into your top five best Stephen King film adaptations. And the fifth film, it's one of those movies that has a tour de force performance from Kathy Bates. Now, one of the things I heard about this was that there were so many other actors that were up for the role of the writer in the movie, but James Caan eventually would be cast. But people like Al Pacino was flirting with it, Robert De Niro, any of them that received that script knew how good the role that Kathy Bates would go on to play. But James Caan, I thought he did a really good job in this film, bearing in mind it's a Kathy Bates movie, and of course she would go on then to win the Oscar.
Yeah, it's a kind of a classic too. Like, it could be very easily seen to be done as a play. James Caan, his career wasn't really, you know, he'd gone from The Godfather, and then there was a kind of a lull in his career up until now, so he, you know, was going to play the more understated of the role. Misery, I think, is one of these films that everyone has seen and everyone is aware of, and everyone's aware of, you know, the Hobbling scene, but I still think it's very, very underrated. I watched it again there recently, and I've forgotten how good it was. So I think the last time I watched it, we rented it on VHS, which goes to show the last time I'd seen it beforehand. But the film is, what, it's 27 years old now, and it still holds up. Kathy Bates, who won the Oscar, as you said, is absolutely terrifying in it. But it's not a case, like, it's not, you know, she doesn't just go full mad. There's these kind of creepy little intricacies to it, you know, like just a smirk or a tone, like up until the fact where she actually hobbles him. She's playing it very kind of, is she just a weirdo? Is she actually trying to help me? Like, you know, we've all kind of been stuck in those conversations with someone who you think there's something just a bit off about them and you just feel uncomfortable around them. Thankfully, no one that breaks your legs with a sledgehammer, but I think she played it a lot more realistic than, you know, the famous scene would make you believe.
It's a brilliant, and you know, also we have to mention Rob Reiner, who directed it. Like, he was on a great run at the time. I mean, in his career, he'd also helm the likes of The Princess Bride and A Few Good Men, and he's one of those directors that really can do wonders with Stephen King's material. So in at number five is Misery. Number four is another filmmaker who very much just is one of the perfect choices to adapt Stephen King's work, and that is Frank Darabont. What is the film you have of his in at number four, Andy?
For me, number four is The Mist, which I think is just one of the best horror films of the last 20 years. It's just plays up the tension so well. Like, I know it's a kind of a giant monster movie, but for the first hour or so of that film, where they're just, you know, people are trapped in a supermarket and they're not sure what's outside, and that paranoia just building and building, and it's that kind of classic horror trope that, you know, you just have people in the dark and afraid, and they're making up their own reality. And it's interesting to see, you know, the sides radicalizing very quickly, and it's a very real thing you could see happening. I think even like if there was no monsters in the film at all, that part of it would be terrifying. And you kind of, without spoiling, it has one of the all-time great endings. Like, forget horror films endings, this is just one of the best endings for anything. Completely changed from the book, and even Stephen King himself has said that's better than anything I could have written. if you haven't seen The Mist, I don't want to spoil the ending just in case you haven't, and if I put somebody onto this, I really hope you do watch it. It's absolutely fantastic. I don't know what your opinion of it is, Gordon. I know you're the horror expert.
Oh, no, I really enjoyed it. And the ending, it's a sucker punch type ending. It's so grim, really is. And you're just left almost open mouth at the end of it going, oh my God.
And again, something like Secret Window, which is all about the twist at the end and nothing like this. Like, you could know the twist to The Mist and still enjoy the film without that spoiling it for you.
Oh, it's such a good film. And also, Frank Darabont also brought it out in black and white as well, so you can check out the monochrome version of it too. Now, Darabont also helmed another great Stephen King movie, and Tom Hanks starred in this one, and this one has so much emotional heft in it as well. Of course, Andy, we're talking about The Green Mile.
Yeah, it's, again, just an absolutely stunning, heartfelt film. Like, there's certain directors, like you said, Rob Ryan or Frank Darabont, who just get that kind of heightened reality. Like, it's kind of interesting that it's not a horror film and it's one of Stephen King's best. The performances, like Michael Clarke Duncan, is like, he was never better than he was in this. And then you've got Percy, the sleazy guard, and he's just a little git who you want to strangle. And then you find out in real life, the character who played him, Doug Hutchinson, is kind of equally as creepy. He was 50 years old and got married to a 16-year-old beauty queen, then paid to kind of make her look like Barbie. So you can kind of see where, it wasn't just a great performance. He is actually that creepy in real life.
It's such a great movie. You might need to have the tissues with you at times for it, because it really does tug at the heartstrings, but it's done in a really good way, not in any way manipulative. Such strong performances all round. But Andy, we need to fly through the list, because Frank Darabont, he features again with another adaptation in at number two. For an awful lot of people, they see this as their favourite film of all time.
Yeah, The Shawshank Redemption for me will probably be a controversial choice at number two. It frequently is, the number one film on IMDb and the number one film of all time. It's in my top 10 films of all time. It's as nearly as perfect a film as you could hope to see. Andy Dufresne, is sentenced to jail for a murder of his wife that he didn't commit. And then it's more about the friendship he strikes up with Morgan Freeman. Like, it's not really about the fact that he's innocent. It's just like a perfect little story about friendship, overcoming the odds. And watched it again recently and absolutely ruined the film at the end, because I've kind of got a theory now that Red, when he gets his parole, is going to go to Andy. As far as, the authorities are concerned, Andy's still a convicted murderer. Like, he's never found innocent for the crimes. They follow Red, they catch Andy. Andy goes back to Shawshank, which has just completely ruined the film for me.
Oh, no, Andy. God, no. You can't be thinking that. but, Andy, the top film in your list of best Stephen King adaptations, I mentioned the director earlier on, Rob Reiner, because he helmed Misery, but he also helmed another film when he was on that great run of his, Reveal All.
For me, the best Stephen King film, the best Stephen King adaptation is Stand By Me. I just think they don't make films like this anymore. Like, I remember, the reason it's kind of ahead of Shawshank for me is I watched this, the first time I seen this, I was kind of the same age as the kids in it, and you can relate to an awful lot. Like, when you were that age, everyone kind of had a group similar to that. They don't make films like that anymore, where the kids actually act like kids. Like, they're little gits, some of them. They smoke, they drink, they, mindless destruction. Now, if you see a kids film, they're all kind of holier than thou, where they're bitten by radioactive spiders. Well, here, they're sneaking guns out. They're telling their parents they're somewhere when they shouldn't. And the whole premise of the film, to go and see a dead body so they can get their picture in the paper. It's quite a dark story, and I don't think it's one you'd see now. And just everything about the film, like the four kids who play it were all absolutely fantastic. The soundtrack is brilliant. Kiefer Sutherland is, the chant, the kind of the scumbag, the cheap dime store hood, as he's called. He's just, terrifying in that film. I find it hard to find a flaw with the film. It's so many great scenes and so many great characters in it. And it's a shame the kind of tragedy what happened to the four kids out of it, the four actors. Their adult life didn't exactly, none of them really went on to any great success.
Yeah, it's a real pity, actually. But again, such strong performances from that young cast. And River Phoenix with there, Corey Feldman, a young Jerry McConnell in there too. And then we had that actor, his name escapes me now, but he went on to star in the likes of Star Trek Next Generation.
Will Wheaton.
There we go, in it as well. Do you know what, Andy? I'm going to have to go back and revisit Stand By Me, because It is really a gem of a movie. Such a well acted, as you said, and a directed film by Rob Reiner. Andy, just before we let you go, The Dark Tower has been slated by most people, so a lot have high hopes for it, which is coming out in September. From the trailers that you've seen, because they've obviously gotten lots of views on YouTube, what's your feeling? How do you think it's going to go?
I think that's going to be really good. I think people are kind of nostalgic into when they're talking about the miniseries. I rewatched that again recently. And apart from Tim Curry's performance, like, there's massive gaps in that film where nothing happened. And I think based on what I can see in the trailer, and I've read the book myself, they've trimmed a lot of the unnecessary stuff from that. This looks like it's going to be something really special. Like, it's going to be hard to top Tim Curry's performance. But I think they've really kind of nailed the atmosphere of it. Like, that first trailer with the ship going into the shore, it looks fantastic. I hope they haven't put everything good in the trailer and the film's awful, but I have really high hopes for this.
Same here, Andy. I hope it's going to be an absolute cracker. And it also has a bit of a Stranger Things vibe going on with it as well. And then the director, I'm still a little bit on the fence with, Anthony Muschietti. His last film, Mama, was okay. Didn't set the world on fire. And bearing in mind, True Detective director Cary Fukunaga was supposed to do it. I just thought, God, imagine what he could have brought to the table. But Andy, we'll have to wait until September to see it. Andy McCarroll, thank you so much for joining me this week to take a look at the best and worst Stephen King film adaptations.
Cheers. Thanks, Jordan.
And that is it for this week's We Love Movies. Next Sunday, we'll be reviewing Tom Cruise's drug caper, American Made, and Catherine Bigelow's timely drama, Detroit, starring Will Poulter, John Boyega, and our very own Jack Rayner. For me, Gordon Hayden, enjoy the rest of your Sunday, and we'll talk to you again next week.